content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is entitled, American Food Will Never Look Natural Again, by Catherine Wu. And this is from May of 2023. In 1856, an amateur chemist named William Henry Perkin mixed a batch of chemicals that he hoped in vain would yield the malaria drug quinine. When Perkin's failed experiment turned purple, a hue so vivid that it could stain silks without fading, he'd realized he'd stumbled upon a completely different marvel of modernity, a commercially viable synthetic dye, the first of a new generation of chemicals that would revolutionize the way humans colored their clothes and, soon after, their food. The edible version of the chemicals in particular were a revelation, offering food manufacturers cheap and convenient alternatives to pigments, squeezed painstakingly from natural sources such as plants, said I. Hisano, a historian and author of Visualizing Taste, How Business Changed the Look of What You Eat. Dyes could keep peas verdant after canning and sausages pink after cooking. They could turn two green oranges more orange and light up the corner shop candy displays. By the Second World War, synthetic dyes had become, as one grocer put it, one of the greatest forces in the world in the sale of foods. And the more foods and with chemicals were introduced, the more the chemicals came to define how those foods should look, the yellow of butter, the crimson of strawberry jello. But after hitting a mid-20th century peak, the roster of synthetic dyes used in Western foods began to shrink. In recent years, European countries have appended warning labels onto the products that contain them. In the United States, has whittled them down to a once long list of approved artificial foods dyes to just 9. The FDA is now reviewing a petition to delist Red Number 3, which colors candy corn, conversation hearts, and certain chewing gums and cake icings. California and New York are mulling legislation that could ban the additive, along with several others, by 2025. The concern is that the dyes add not just colors, but a substantial health risk. Several of the compounds have been linked to patterns of hyperactivity and restlessness in kids. Red number 3 has been known since the 1980s to cause cancer in rats. The precise explanation for the harm is unclear. Research into the issue has been spotty, and there has been no comprehensive set of data that says this is the mechanism, according to Elad Taco, a food scientist at Cornell University. Several respected researchers have even dismissed the evidence as overhyped. More than a century into the dye's tenures, there is not even consensus on the fact that they are dangerous or what happens when our bodies snarf them down, says Monica Justy, a food scientist at Ohio State University. Even so, the argument against artificial food dyes seems as though it should be simple. They have no known nutritional benefits and potentially carry several health risks. We're talking about something that's cosmetic versus something that is hurting kids, says Lisa Lefferts, an environmental health consultant, who has petitioned the FDA to ban Red Number 3 next year. And yet, the dyes endure precisely because they offer our foods and our eyes shades that nature never could. When synthetic food dyes were newer, their shortcomings were hard to miss. One of the colorant's main ingredients was derived from the byproducts of the process that turns coal into fuel. And in the absence of careful scrutiny, some early batches of the dyes ended up contaminated with arsenic, mercury, and lead, Companies also use the dyes to conceal defects or spoilage that then sickened many people. By the 1930s, Congress required, among other safety measures, that government scientists vet the chemicals safety and restricted companies to sourcing exclusively from an approved list. But dangerous chemicals seemed to keep slipping through. In the 1950s, after a batch of Halloween candy sickened several children, FDA scientists found that the culprit was a synthetic that had turned the treats orange, a dye so toxic that it caused organ damage and even premature death in animals in labs. The agency hastily banned it, and by the late 70s, axed nearly a dozen other synthetic dyes linked to cancers and organ damage in animals. Today, Americans regularly see just 7 artificial dyes in their foods. 2 others are used very sparingly. Still, roughly 19 million pounds of the 7 prevalent synthetic dyes were certified by the FDA to flood the U.S. food supply in fiscal year 2022, and no one agrees on which colorants pose the biggest threat. In the European Union and the United Kingdom, foods containing any of 6 synthetic food dyes, including the 3 most common ones in the U.S., red number 40, yellow number 5, and yellow number 6, must warn consumers that the colorants may have an adverse effect on activity and attention in children. The FDA, however, has yet to adopt any such posture, even though it's long since delisted red number 2, which is still allowed in Europe. Even red number 3, which has been linked to both cancer in animals and behavioral issues in kids, and may be one of the most concerning additives remaining in the American food supply, according to Peter Lorre, the president and executive director of the Center of Science in the Public Interest, carries a mixed rap. The FDA banned it from cosmetics and externally applied drugs decades ago, but still allows it in food. Countries in Europe have restricted its use, but don't mind adding it to certain canned cherries to maintain their hue. On the whole, the International Association of Color Manufacturers, which represents the color additives industry, told me that the claims around food dyes and health risks aren't sound, pointing out that many of the studies on synthetic colors have yielded conflicting results. The FDA, too, maintains that color additives are very safe when used properly. The links, to be fair, are tough to study. With behavior-focused outcomes in kids, for instance, you're looking at more subtle kinds of changes that you find on a population basis, and some children seem more sensitive than others, further muddying the statistics, said Linda Birnbaum, the former director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Studies, Health Sciences, and the National Toxicology Program. And some laboratory studies on the chemicals have delivered them into rodents in high doses or via tubes down their throat, making the data's relevance to us a bit shakier. But although some argue that there's not enough evidence to conclude that the dyes definitely pose a peril, others rightly note that there's also insufficient data to conclude that they don't. For all the pounds of the chemicals we've gulped down, there are still more questions and answers about artificial colorants, says Diego Luna Vito, a food scientist at the Monterrey Institute of Technology and Higher Education in Mexico. Lefferts, the environmental health consultant, is one of the researchers who is one of several researchers who'd rather err on the side of caution and expunge the entire current roster of artificial food dyes. The potential losses seem negligible, she told me, and the possible benefits immense. Scientists may not even know the extent of the dyes' issues. Just last year, a group led by Walil Khan of McMaster University published evidence that red number 40 may raise the risk of colitis in mice. But without an outright push from the FDA, manufacturers have little incentive to change their practices. And there's not exactly a clear-cut path toward developing new synthetic colorants with less dubious safety profile. Without identifying why current dyes may be dangerous, scientists can't purposely avoid the root problem in future ones, says Thomas Galligan, CSPI's principal scientist for food additives and supplements. In the background of the fight over artificial dyes, the colorant's natural counterparts are making a slow and steady comeback. In the EU and the UK, consumers can find Starburst and M&M's tinted mostly with plant extracts. And in the U.S., Kraft has recreated the artificial orange hue of its mac and cheese with a blend of annatto, turmeric, and paprika. Recent surveys have shown a growing contingent of the global population is eager to eat cleaner ingredients, not, as Jim Murphy, the former president of General Mills, once put it, colors with numbers on their foods. But in late 2017, Murphy would go on to eat his words after his company's all-natural version of Trix debuted and rapidly tanked. Trix traditionalists were horrified at the revamped recipe's muted melange of purpley reds and orangey yellows, devoid of the greens and blues that General Mills had struggled to naturally replicate. They called it disgusting and basically a salad now. Just 2 years after pledging to purge its products of artificial additives, General Mills reinstated classic Trix, complete with its synthetics-laden ingredient list. A similar story played out with Necco, which removed the artificial dyes from its wafers only to quickly return them. Mars, too, publicly promised to remove synthetics from its American products, then let its self-imposed deadline pass without making good. Natural dyes, it turns out, are still a chore to work with for the same reasons they were once so easily replaced. They're expensive to extract and process, their colors are inconsistent, and tend to fade quite fast, especially in the presence of light and heat, Luna Vital told me. Humans are also limited to what nature has available and the fickleness of those compounds. They often change on us, Justy told me, when researchers mix them into recipes. Sometimes the colors even impart unwanted flavors or funk. Several companies, including Sensia and Calsec, told me they are now trying to introduce modifications or tweaks that enhance natural pigments' stability and vibrancy to help them compete. But the more tinkering happens, the more these new dyes could start to resemble the ones that researchers want them to oust. Nowadays, even natural colorants are artificially created on some level, Isana, the historian, told me. And although the FDA's regulatory standards assume that plant, animal, and mineral-derived dyes will be safer alternatives to synthetics, going as far as to exempt them from certain tests, relying on the simple reassurance that a source is natural is, admittedly, not the strongest scientific argument. Michael Jacobson, the former executive director of CSPI, told me, "Nature made, after all, has never been synonymous with safe. It wasn't so long ago that bakers were bleaching their breads with chalk, and dairy manufacturers were tinging their milks yellow with lead chromate." There is technically another option, abstaining from adding colors to foods at all. But that would fundamentally transform how we experience our meals. Added dyes and pigments, both artificial and natural, are mainstays not just of sports drinks and packaged sweets, but also salad dressing, yogurt, pickles, peanut butter, dried and smoked meats. They're what makes farmed salmon flesh pink. Vision is key to taste. There's probably no other sensory cue that gives us as much information about what we're about to eat, says Charles Spence, an experimental psychologist at the University of Oxford. In what might be an echo of the preferences that helped our ancestors find ripe fruits, Spence told me, our modern brain still tends to link pinks and reds to sugar and yellows and greens to all things tart. Colors can play tricks, too. When researchers artificially darken the tint of drinks or yogurt, study subjects insist that it tastes sweeter. When consumers see a rainbow of color, a rainbow of flavors in their snacks, the sheer appeal of variety may persuade them, some of them, to eat more. Some of artificial dyes' biggest dangers, then, may not even be entirely inherent to the chemicals themselves. Foods that need a color boost tend to be the ones that experts want us to avoid. Candies, sodas, and packaged processed snacks, especially those marketed to children, points out Lindsay Moyer, a CSPI nutritionist. Colors so exaggerated, so surprising, so unnatural, inevitably tempt kids to reach out of the grocery cart, Moyer told me. Dyes once cooked up by us to mimic and juxtapose with the natural world have long since altered us, manipulating our base instincts, warping our appetites, and transforming into a luxury that the world now seems entirely unable to quit. Next, America's unconvincing reasons for denying F-16s to Ukraine. Before giving Kyiv the weapons that it needs, the U.S. always works through a list of excuses. By Phillips Payson O'Brien and Edward Stringer. Before each decision to arm Ukraine with a new category of powerful arms, NATO partners progress through three stages of denial. First comes the outright dismissal of the country's ability to effectively deploy the weapons in question against Russian invaders. Ukraine could never use these. The argument has been applied to multiple rocket launch systems, anti-aircraft systems, and sophisticated tanks, because they are just too complex. Next comes a qualified dismissal. Ukrainian forces might be able to use these systems, but equipping and training them would take far too long. Then comes a desperate third stage. Yes, Ukraine can use those weapons, which could make a big difference in the war, but we worry about how Russia or China might respond. This view, though not always publicly voiced, almost certainly is the reason the United States and other Western powers are holding back some arms. On the question of whether the West will provide F-16s, a capable but relatively simple lightweight fighter aircraft widely used by NATO members, the discussion is stuck somewhere between stages 1 and 2. Ukraine clearly needs improved air defense capabilities, and so is constantly pleading for F-16s. The U.S. is rejecting these appeals primarily with technical and logistical arguments. Colin Kale, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, has repeatedly claimed in recent weeks that Ukraine would need 18 months to be able to deploy and operate F-16s. The suggestion is that people should stop pressuring the U.S. to provide these planes because they could never arrive in time to make a difference. Yet Ukraine would not be educating F-16 pilots from scratch. It has a large number of experienced MiG-29 and Sukhoi Su-27 pilots who have the added benefit of many months of combat flying. Comments by some current and former senior officials from NATO suggest that qualified, experienced fighter pilots might need only a few months of training. From the Ukrainian Armed Forces' strong record of accomplishment, we can assume that Ukraine would not find it any more difficult to maintain F-16s than to learn how to fly them. Retired U.S. Air Force General Phil Breedlove, a former Supreme Allied Commander for Europe, who has also worked closely with the Ukrainian Air Forces, expresses confidence in its abilities. There are very few absolutes in this Russian war on Ukraine, Breedlove told us in an email. But one thing that is absolutely consistent is that we always overestimate how long it will take Ukraine to assimilate and learn to employ the Western weapons given to them. In the past, Breedlove points out, Ukrainians have even had certain lessons for NATO. In the case of weapons such as the counter-battery radars we supplied them in the 2014 Russian invasion of Ukraine, they have taught us how to use them better. Having F-16s would broaden Ukraine's ability to shoot down incoming Russian missiles and drones. During last year's campaigns, the Russians relied on a wide range of attack platforms, relatively simple and inexpensive Iranian Shahed drones, repurposed S-300 anti-aircraft missiles, and more advanced Kalibr cruise missiles, and even Russia's latest Kinzhal hypersonic missiles. To shoot down just some of this weaponry, the Ukrainians had to rely overwhelmingly on ground-based anti-air systems, to such a degree that rumors spread that Ukraine was or would soon be running short. Without the airborne defenses, something F-16s would help provide, Ukraine is, to use a sports metaphor, defending on its own goal line. Instead of a systematic defense of the skies, the Ukrainians are fending off attacks on targeted infrastructure point by point. Any defense that relies on last-ditch saves is notably a poor one. Granted, Ukraine would face some challenges using F-16s to maximum effect. Any F-16 fleet would require a regular resupply of Western air-to-air missiles. The real problem here may well be that NATO fears exhausting its collective arsenal of such weapons. If so, the West needs to ramp up production in its own interest, rather than nervously guarding existing supplies when they could be put to good use in Ukraine. Even with F-16s, Ukraine would not be able to use air power according to NATO doctrine, in which mutually complementary types of aircraft protect one another. But in the limited confines of the Ukrainian battle space, such high-end airborne capabilities designed to operate at long range in an enemy airspace would be less important. Still, Ukraine's primary need is to keep one step ahead of the Russian air forces to maintain primacy over the battlefield, that is, over Ukrainian territory. It must keep Russian aircraft on the defensive and prevent it from affecting any coming Ukrainian offensive. Ukrainian air power doesn't need to attain NATO standards to serve that goal. To that more limited end, Western allies should also consider expanding Ukraine's ground-based electronic warfare systems, continuing to reinforce its surface-to-air missile capability, enhancing its proven ability in prototype warfare, the deployment of experimental military technology, primarily to shoot down Russian surface-to-air missiles along the front line, and integrating its various defenses via a ground-based communications network. With these improvements, the F-16s could operate in relative safety, and it would pose enough of a threat to thwart many Russian offensive missions before they could prosecute their attacks on Ukraine. This would reduce the emerging threat posed by Russian new glide bombs launched at high speed from aircraft remaining behind Russia's own lines, a big win for Ukraine's strategic aims. Skeptics who argue that preparing Ukrainian forces to deploy and maintain F-16s will take too long to do much good are creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. The longer they draw out the process of getting a beleaguered country the weapons it needs, the more trouble that country will have in repelling the invaders. The sooner Ukraine has access to F-16s, the sooner it can fight the war far more effectively. Already, these delaying tactics mean it is too late to have any F-16s play a role in an expected Ukrainian spring and summer offensive. However, if the West moves soon, Ukraine could have essential assistance in place by the fall. It will need the help. Last winter, the Russians embarked on a well-publicized strategic campaign against power plants and other Ukrainian infrastructure. Though the campaign failed, the Russians are very likely to attempt something similar this year, having learned from their previous failures. For all the West's technical objections to giving F-16s to Ukraine, the real objection is likely based on fears of escalation. Never mind that Russia's blood-curdling threats of escalation have proved hollow again and again, and that Ukraine has abided by limits that skittish Western powers have put on the use of the weapons they are supplying. In the end, providing Ukraine with F-16s as soon as possible would make a major difference in Ukraine's ability to both wage defensive war and to go on offensive to reclaim its territory. It would allow Ukrainians, finally, to conduct ground operations in a comprehensive manner and to defend their cities and power generation systems. It would help them win this war as quickly as possible with the fewest losses. Next, from March of 2022, An Ode to Giving People Money by James Parker. It's primal, it's biblical, it's the moral physics of the universe in action. They have meats, the have not. In the subway, on the street, at the traffic light, along the underpass, anywhere in America, what happens next? You patently have warmth, comfort, accessible hygiene, a fridge, a place to go, a buffer or two against intolerable pressure. The person in front of you, patently, has not. A look suffices to tell you that. Their lack imprints itself upon your abundance, and they're asking you for money. Do you give it? Should you? Must you? Do you want to? We can dispense immediately with the traditional canard. They'll only spend it on drugs. What a pernicious mingling of Ayn Rand-ian screw-em-ism and faux liberal concern. Maybe they'll spend it on drugs. Or maybe they'll spend it on a new copy of William James' The Varieties of Religious Experience to replace the one that disappeared when their campsite of 2 years ago was deconstructed, in their absence, by park rangers. The point is, how they spend it is none of your business. Let's get back to the encounter itself. Awkward, isn't it? The system of which you are a functioning part has thrown the person before you into a transparent condition of penury and exile. Perhaps you feel a flickering of shame, and then a flickering of annoyance at the flickering of shame. Affluence is no picnic. You have a prescription to refill, a phone to upgrade, a car to get repaired. This need, it's too much. Here's my tip. If you're temperamentally indisposed, keep your money. A penny given a poor man grudgingly, wrote the French Catholic mystic Léon Blois, pierces the poor man's hand, falls, pierces the earth, bores holes in suns, crosses the firmament, and compromises the universe. So don't do that. But if you are inclined to give, then give wholeheartedly, not for charity, not for empathy, not for any groaning abstraction, but that the divine economy of giving might circulate through you unobstructed, through your glands and through your veins. The person before you needs money, and you need to give it. Unplug the wellspring of life and hand it over. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a wonderful day.